Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Charles Manson, Charlie Chaplin, Frank Lloyd Wright, and Chuck Berry. What do these four men have in common? They were all charged with the Mann Act, also known as the White Slavery Law. The Progressive Era Law has been on the books for over 100 years. It was used to build up the FBI into a national police force to enforce a moral code against sexual deviancy. Along the way, it also promoted gender roles for women. What do you think about the Mann Act and its salacious history? With sex trafficking still a major problem, do we need the Mann Act more now than ever? We invite you into our conversation. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. You can also email your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org and go to the comments section on our website at tpr.org. Our guest this half hour is Jessica R. Pliley, professor of women's history at Texas State University. Her book is Policing Sexuality, The Mann Act and the Making of the FBI, published by Harvard University Press. And welcome to The Source, Jessica. So as we're waiting for our board operator to figure out what switch needs to be switched in order to hear Jessica. Jessica, can you hear me now? We are talking about the Mann Act, a law that was put on the book in 1910. It's not about man. It's not about the male. It's Mann, M-A-N-N, named after the congressman who put it through from Illinois at the time. Part of the Progressive Era, it was signed into law by Taft, and it was put in place after there was generally a public outrage, a perception that there was mass white slavery happening in the country due to immigrants now in the country and changing roles in the country due to so many people moving from the rural eras, agricultural communities, into the cities and changing roles for women. And there was a perception that there was mass kidnapping happening in the country and taking white women and forcing them into prostitution. And with me now on the line, I believe, is Jessica R. Pliley. Jessica, are you there?
I am.
All right. So I was giving kind of a summary about what I thought the Mann Act was about as I was waiting for you to get clear. So was that about right?
Well, I only heard the last bit of what you said.
Okay, about how there was a perception leading to this passage in 1910 that there was mass kidnappings of white girls and forced into prostitution.
Yeah, there was just a generalized concern of coerced prostitution was prevalent throughout the United States. And the way that was expressed is that it might be kidnappings, but it could also be economic coercion or debt bondage that would keep women in brothels. And so this law was passed to fight those types of tactics.
Now, you call it in your book a myth, but is it a myth?
Well, I think historians have typically emphasized the mythic nature of it and the way that the discussions about white slavery capitalized on anxieties about immigration and women's employment. But on the other hand, you do see that this is a period of intense sexual conflict and street harassment, and there are certainly some evidence for sexual enslavement in brothels, although I tend to think that the vast majority of sex workers chose sex work because it was economically rewarding at the time.
And they didn't have many options.
No, and it paid very, very well compared to, women's factory work and things like that.
But the perception was that there were men, pimps, who were beating women and forcing them into this line of work, and they would not leave them with any of the proceeds.
Exactly.
So we saw that there, after the passage of the Mann Act, named for Congressman James Robert Mann of Illinois, so it's not necessarily about a male, but it does seem like an appropriate name for the law, right?
It seems to be kind of one of those silly puns of history. At the time, it was referred more commonly as the White Slave Traffic Act, and it starts being called the Mann Act probably around like 1916 to present.
Right. And so one of the most prominent people who were prosecuted under the Mann Act was a boxer, Jack Johnson.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yes. So Jack Johnson was not only very, very famous for his athletic prowess, but and particularly he was a heavyweight champion of the world. And in 1910, he had beat Jim Jeffries, who was a white boxer. and his victory prompted race riots throughout the country. And so he was very, very famous for his athletics, but he was also just as famous for the fact that he preferred white women as his romantic and sexual partners, thereby violating the entire racial caste system of the U.S. And so because of that, at one point, federal officials were very interested in making a symbol out of him. And so he was charged with violating the Mann Act because he had transported one of his girlfriends over state lines. She was a well-known prostitute, and she and so the notion was is that perhaps he was transporting her for commercial reasons, although honestly it was for recreational and for sexual reasons. And so he was absolutely convicted, and even the judge in the case commented that he was going to make, you know, a symbol of Jack Johnson and punish him as much as he could. And then Jack Johnson became even more famous when he actually fled the country to evade jail. And this was the beginning of his period of exile, where he lived in Europe and traveled throughout the world, boxing in Australia and various other places.
Right. So I want to go back to the phrase, the race riots that you use. Now, it's a loaded term, and I don't think it's an accurate term. And I think more of a word to use is lynchings.
Well, and I think that, or perhaps what you saw is in the aftermath of the match, very intoxicated, angry white mobs would go into black neighborhoods, and they would destroy property, and they would kind of just inflict generalized violence. Not exactly lynchings, although...
There were lynchings after the fight.
Right. Yeah, so in that case, you would have individual cases of lynching, but then other cases, it's just more white terrorism on black neighborhoods.
Right, and I think that is more accurate. But to call it race riots, some people see that as an interaction of violence, when more it is actually one segment of the population inflicting it on another segment of the population, white on black.
Sure.
Okay, so but Jack Johnson eventually came back. He did serve a year in prison, but it seemed very selective that he was targeted for this law.
Absolutely, and the cases that I look at are not the celebrity cases. They are the more kind of run-of-the-mill cases. And when you compare Jack Johnson's conviction to the more kind of quotidian cases, it even stands out as even that much more exceptional, because typically any white woman who kind of voluntarily had sexual contact with black men all of a sudden could not call upon this law. They were seen as kind of having violated their racial privilege.
Right. They lost their conditional whiteness.
Exactly. And so, so in the Jack Johnson case, it's a perfect example of the way that the Mann Act has been used very selectively by the Bureau of Investigation to go after prominent celebrities.
So we're going to talk more about the Mann Act, the white slavery law, how it built up the FBI, how it was enforced, what it meant to about sexual behavior in the United States from 1910 until now. We invite you into our conversation. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX.
Support for KSTX comes from Ballet San Antonio, presenting The Nutcracker, the holiday classic performed with live music by the San Antonio Symphony, November 28th through December 7th at 2 and 7 p.m. at the Tobin Center for the Performing Arts. More at balletsanantonio.org. From the KSTX Community Events Calendar, Lackland Air Force Base's Operation Home Cooking is seeking local families and individuals to host airmen and trainees for the Thanksgiving holidays. The Center for Refugee Services in San Antonio presents a World Mosaic Market daily through December 24th. And Ballet San Antonio presents The Nutcracker at the Tobin Center for the Performing Arts through December 7th. Find details on these events and more at tpr.org. The Community Events Calendar is a public service of KSTX.
This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. America's first anti-sex trafficking law, the 1910 Mann Act, made it illegal to transport women over state lines for prostitution or any other immoral purpose. It was meant to protect women and girls from being seduced or sold into slavery, but as Jessica Pliley shows us in her book, that its enforcement also often resulted in the policing of women's sexual behavior. We're talking about the Mann Act and white slavery law and how it's being used today and its legacy and how it built up the FBI. We invite you to our conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. So Jessica, why is it interesting that this is helped build up the FBI or was responsible for turning the FBI into a national mega police force?
Well, one of the things that my work shows is that when this law was passed in 1910, the FBI had only 61 agents. So it was rather small. It couldn't arrest anybody. It was an investigatory agency only. And within 3 years after the passage of this law, it had well over 300 special agents. It had national reach. It had offices here in Texas and, you know, in Wyoming and throughout the country. And the Mann Act, or investigating the Mann Act, during these years made up kind of the day-to-day work of the FBI until other national, federal, you know, criminal statutes were passed. And so I really think that it's by enforcing the Mann Act that the FBI was well-positioned to, you know, to fight German surveillance during World War One, or to pursue its anti-communist and anti-radical agenda during the Red Scare in 1919. If it hadn't had the Mann Act, it would never have had the national reach to be able to wage those programs.
So you said there were offices all over the country. There was one in San Antonio and a prominent officer, Frank Stone. What was up with Frank Stone?
Oh, Frank Stone's a fun guy. He actually has his background in the Immigration Bureau first, and he was stationed here in Texas, and he was asked to investigate prostitution and sex trafficking in 1909. And he travels all throughout the state, and he describes the kind of the moral conditions of each city that he goes to. So he finds Austin to be a city where that has very high-end kind of sexual marketplace because the legislators prefer Anglo luxury women, whereas in other cities are marked for their, you know, more diverse offerings. He marks Fort Worth as being one of the rottenest cities he's ever been to. And later, after the Mann Act is passed in 1910, he joins the Bureau of Investigation, where he continues investigating kind of sex trafficking throughout the state. He finally, though, is repositioned, I think, to New Jersey during World War One, where he is busy investigating anarchists when he dies. But yeah, he's somewhat of a fun little figure.
Right. It looks like the reports that he would write would read like salacious magazine articles from the, you know, tabloids or something.
Yeah, he had a flair for writing, and he seemed to have a flair for, like, getting people to talk to him. So at one point, he meets with a judge, and the judge freely admits to having accepted bribes from brothel owners, says that he can't pay his bills without accepting those bribes, and then goes forward and actually offers to show Frank a good hot time, you know, throughout the city's different red light district establishments. And so he seemed to draw the best out of people in terms of getting them to divulge their secrets.
So at this time, around 1910 and 1914, there was red light districts were a common part of cities like San Antonio, Houston, Dallas, and there were legalized prostitution in these areas.
They were relatively public. Some cities would regulate their red light districts and charge sex workers a registration fee and have them medically examined. Here I'm thinking of El Paso. Other cities just tolerated their existence, and the police would keep an informal eye on those neighborhoods. Almost every city had a red light district if it had a large enough population. This was quite common up until World War One, and it's the growth of the war that absolutely closes the public brothel in the United States, with the exception, of course, of a few counties in Nevada. So when the war is happening, the figures in the YMCA and American Social Hygiene Association manage to take, or they're given quite a bit of power, and they pass a lot of policies that make prostitution near military bases illegal. And these are the same people who are pushing for prohibition. So they want kind of a cleaner moral standard for American young men, especially young enlisted men.
Okay, let's go to the phone lines. Lisa has called in. Lisa, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I think that although we can look back and see that the Mann Act has, caused some abuses with the FBI and so on, and that we have a more open society now, I still think some of the laws that were passed, or some, such as the law prohibiting the transporting of women over the state line for immoral purposes, I can remember back as a teenager in South Carolina that saved me one time from getting married when I was 15. I mean, I think personally that the that sex trafficking of young girls in our country continues to be a terrible problem, although that was not my case. But it is a problem in our country, and I think that weakening that particular law would not help women.
Okay, Lisa, can you tell us a little bit more about how the law saved you?
Well, it was just that I had a boyfriend that was over 18 and I was under 18, and we wanted to get married. And we decided, we realized that we could cross the state line and go to Georgia, I think, and get married. But my boyfriend's father at the time said to him, "Now, son, you cannot cross the state line with your girlfriend. This would be a terrible thing. There's a law against that." And so as a result, we put this off, and honestly, you know, then I went on and, you know, went to college and had a very different life than I might have had. And I just think that this is a good stumbling block for the wrong direction for girls and young men, and it helps them to have that law.
Okay, Lisa, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. So sex trafficking, major problem here internationally and here in the United States. Does the Mann Act still play a role in trying to crack down on sex trafficking?
Oh, absolutely. If anything, the Mann Act has been appreciating kind of a renaissance. It's a very powerful tool that the FBI has, and it does use it against traffickers, more so recently in the last maybe 5 years or so. And it helps fortify the rest of the United States trafficking policy, particularly the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which helps victims of trafficking, especially international trafficking, gain access to social services and, victims assistance here in the country. So it's an important part of our anti-trafficking policy.
It's been amended a few times by Congress. It has been some of the gender language in it has been taken out so that it applies to men and women for being trafficked. And also it has kind of removed some of the language about sexual deviancy, which was critical because that sexual deviancy part of it was it turned the FBI in kind of a morality police.
Well, and the problem with the deviancy is they use the word debauchery, which is has a very vexed history as a legal term, and it's very vague. And so making the law more specific about what type of sex trafficking is covered and not covered, I think, has improved the law over the years. But, you know, as of 15 years ago, the Mann Act was seen as somewhat of a dead-letter law, and it's only been with this contemporary anti-trafficking movement that it has its potential for being used against sex traffickers has really been realized.
And the Supreme Court has upheld it multiple times.
Yes, many, many times. The most important time for my story is in 1917 when it does uphold that any other immoral purpose clause to protect exactly, young women like the caller.
Yeah, but critics say that the law, though, adopted to protect women from being abducted and forced into prostitution, white slavery, that it actually has been used to hurt women more so.
It's been used to police women, but also to police men's sexual behavior. So one of the things that I find is the ways that families use this law to both police and to attempt to protect their daughters, or the way that some men would use it to help track down runaway wives. So it definitely has this kind of ambiguous legacy. But it reflected the values of the time. So in the 1930s, when it's being used to police daughters' sexuality, it was yet one tool in a large kind of legal tool set available to parents for protecting or policing their daughters' sexuality.
But did this give the FBI license to spy on people and then blackmail them?
It certainly gave them quite a bit of license, but in my cases, I find that well over 60% of the cases, it's family members and individuals connected to the case who are inviting the FBI in. So this is not just a simple story of the FBI peering into American bedrooms. It's anything, it's about Americans opening up the shutters of their own bedrooms and inviting the FBI's surveillance. Now, when you have your cases of celebrity persecution, like Jack Johnson, that's a totally different set of cases.
And there certainly is a history of racial, figuring out who's going to get prosecuted. Like Chuck Berry, who was in jail for 22 months for the Mann Act. And the other people mentioned, like Charlie Chaplin, Frank Lloyd Wright, they didn't get convicted or go to jail for it.
No, and I think that is that legacy that's, that the FBI still has to contend with the way that it policed both racial minorities and civil rights groups throughout the 20th century. And so for the average African-American family, when they turned to the FBI for aid, if they wanted to use the Mann Act, the FBI actually closed their doors to them. So they couldn't there's only very few cases I find with black victims. The vast majority of the victims in the cases I see are people who identify as native-born white. And so it's seen as kind of this law that's available on the day-to-day level to protect kind of white middle American families who are inviting the FBI in, not that the FBI is going and finding them.
All right. Thank you so much. Our guest this half hour has been Jessica R. Pliley, professor of women's history at Texas State University. Her book is Policing Sexuality, The Mann Act and the Making of the FBI, published by Harvard University Press. Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Great. Thank you so much.
And this is The Source on KSTX. Thanks for tuning us in.